Good afternoon, everyone. I think most of you have heard the expression and perhaps have even used it yourself at times. I have to do this, or this needs to happen before I can get on with my life. That expression, get on with my life. Until I finish this, or until this obstacle is removed, I can't really live. I'm just kind of treading water, kind of biding my time. But when this happens, whatever the event, whatever the specific thing is, when this happens, then I will be able to get on with my life. You know, if you think back to when you were very young, in grade school, for example, and I don't know exactly where this concept originates, but I know when we were getting toward the end of grade school, like the 7th or 8th grade, and we didn't have a middle school where I went to school, but went directly from grade school to high school. So you can substitute a middle school between grade school and high school. You go through the same type of thinking. We could hardly wait to leave grade school and go to high school. There was something about high school that just was attractive. We could be with the big kids now. No more playing around with the kids in grade school. We could get our driver's license. And of course, when you were in grade school, or when you were actually in high school even, you were always fearful that the age limit for getting a license would be raised from 16 to 18. You were always worried about that, because you wanted to have your license. You wanted to be able to drive. You wanted to be able to go on dates. You wanted to be able to drive to basketball or whatever games, football games. So when you got to high school, you see, all of these things would be available. And then, you know, you'd really be living. You could really get on with your life in high school. And of course, as you approach graduation in high school and start thinking about what's next, what's coming next, and for a number of people going on to college at that time, oh, I can hardly wait to get to college, because then I'll be able to take courses I really like. I won't have all of these requirements. Oh yeah, wait until they got there and they found out there were requirements. They may have had courses that they enjoyed taking, but they had to do the requirements as well. But in any event, there is this concept. Once I get out of high school and get to college, then I can really get on with my life. And maybe some opted to go into the service because they thought, well, there were programs that would help pay for their education. And so that was an attractive thing that was kind of out there for those that wanted a college education but at the time couldn't afford it. So they thought, well, okay, once I get into the service and get my service obligation over, then I'll be able to get on with my life. And of course, while they were in the service, many of them found they could hardly wait to get out of there, because it wasn't really the life for a lot of people. Anyway, they're in college now, and then they start thinking, as they start getting toward graduation, that maybe they should take an advanced degree, because with a master's degree, then I'll be qualified to do this. Or with a doctorate, then I can teach, I can become a professor, and then I can really get on with my life then, once I've done that. Or if they decided they want to go into the medical profession. I can hardly wait to get to medical school, because then in that 4 years I can really concentrate on becoming to be a doctor. And then when they are toward the end of that, they're looking forward to residency. And so this kind of thinking progresses. At some point along the way, they start thinking about marriage. Well, when I get a wife, then I can get on with my life again. I don't have to worry about going through the dating game anymore. We can settle down, we can start a family, and that's the next element, and so it goes. Then the job, whatever job or profession they end up in. I can hardly wait till I become partner, because then I'll have this esteem. I'll have a bigger salary. I can drive a nicer car. We can live in a different neighborhood. And then I'll really be able to live. I can really get on with my life then. Time passes. They have children. The children grow up. And boy, will we be so glad when they leave home finally. Finally, we'll be able to get on with our lives. And of course, that never happens. If all of you have children, no, you never lose your children. They'll always come back. So forget that part of it. But ultimately, you reach retirement age. And you start thinking about, oh, just wait till I no longer have to get up at 8 every morning, get up at 5 so I can get to work at 8 or whatever. Just wait till I can sleep in as long as I want, till I can retire, and then we'll be able to do all of the things we always wanted to do, to travel, to go to different places, to pursue certain leisurely activities, and then we'll really be able to get on with our lives. And then they reach retirement. A lot of times they find at that age, there are other parts of their body that have retired as well, and so they may not have quite the same energy, quite the same interest, quite the same ability to get around, and so some of these things they were looking forward to doing are no longer in reach. Maybe, just maybe, some of you here today in this room, or those listening to me on the internet, maybe you're struggling with some particular problem that seems to be making it impossible for you to get on with your life the way you view it. Now, there can be a variety of reasons for that, and I'm not going to go through all of the different problems or types of problems we encounter along the way. Maybe you've been slighted by someone, and that has caused you so much grief in your life that it's been impossible for you to forget about it, much less forgive the person. Maybe you haven't been promoted at work. Maybe you haven't been ordained within the church. Maybe something like that has happened, or you didn't get the job that you thought you deserved. You didn't get the man or woman that you wanted to marry. You had a disagreement with someone and felt slighted to the point that you thought, well, I can no longer trust that person. And it kind of reminds you of what you encounter as a child playing with a toy or a game with some of the kids that you grew up with, and how things would go really well until finally someone would get mad about something, the way the game was being conducted, or the way they were being treated, or they didn't have as much time with this doll or this truck as the other person did, and finally someone would stomp their foot, shake their fist and indignantly get up and get out and say, I'm never going to play with you anymore. You know, the nice thing about that with children is, for the most part, those feelings with them are short-lived. Then a few days later, they're right back playing and best friends again. Unfortunately, when it comes to adults, that doesn't happen as often. And what sometimes starts as a small item can get blown all out of proportion and become an impasse ending a beautiful friendship. I'd like to go to the book of Esther today and look at an example of a very unique woman, one of the strong women in the Bible, who thought, because of her position, because of the fact she was a queen at the time this happened, that she could avoid a very, very difficult situation affecting her race. Now, Esther was a Jew who was selected to be the wife of King Ahasuerus. Therefore, or thereafter, or hereafter, referred to as the king, because if I pronounce that five times, it'll come out five different ways. And in order to spare your ears and my voice, he's simply going to be referred to as the king. Now, he didn't know that Esther was a Jew. Mordecai, her uncle, would not bow or give reverence to Haman, who at that time was the king's right-hand man. And that angered him to such a degree and to such a point that he was able to talk the king into signing an edict that on the 13th day of the 12th month, the people in that kingdom had the license to fall on all the Jews and kill them. Now, you can see how much influence Haman had. He was telling the king, and the thing that precipitated this edict was the fact that, you know, you can't trust this group of people. They're foreigners. They're subversive. They talk about you behind your back, and they won't pay reverence, thinking, of course, of Mordecai. Anyway, the 13th day of the 12th month, the people had the license to fall on the Jews and kill them. And when I think of the 13th, I didn't research this. Maybe this was the original Friday the 13th. I didn't have the interest in trying to figure that out. But in any event, the edict went out, and Mordecai sent a message to his niece, Esther, who, as I said before, was now the queen, for help in saving the Jews. And this was her reply in Esther 4, verse 11. Esther 4, verse 11, and I'm reading from the NLT. All the king's officials and even the people in the provinces know that anyone who appears before the king in his inner court without being invited is doomed to die unless the king holds out his golden scepter, signifying that he has, or whoever approaches him, has the or is invited to come in, because many times someone trying to intrude would simply be taken away and killed. That'd be the end of it. And Esther continues in saying, but the king has not called for me to come to him for the past 30 days. I haven't seen him during this last month. So the inference being, since he hasn't invited me to visit him, why do you think he'll be so kind to me now. Verse 13, Mordecai sent this reply to her. Don't you think for a moment that because you're in the palace, because you occupy a royal position now, do you think that'll make any difference? Do you think you will escape when all the other Jews are killed? Verse 14, if you keep quiet at a time like this, deliverance and relief for the Jews will arise from some other place. God is not going to let this race be annihilated. And through some other miracle, some other way, they will be protected. But if you don't take this responsibility upon yourself, you and your relatives will die. So this was a really severe warning. And then here, I think, is a key verse, a very key verse. And it goes back to, you know, when you're going to get on with your life. What event is going to happen that's going to allow you to get on with your life? Well, in this case, this was key to doing it. Who knows if perhaps you were made queen for just such a time as this? In order to select a queen as a successor to the queen that was before her, they took this group of young virgins, they schooled them, they taught them all of the things they needed to know to be a queen, but then it was up to the king to select the person based on a variety of things. Certainly including their appearance. But Mordecai said, who knows if perhaps out of all of these women that he interviewed, that he could have selected, if perhaps you were made queen for just such a time as this. Leaving this for a minute, let's think about this. Maybe God has made you and put you here at this time and at this place so you will be able to intervene in the course of someone's life and not save a nation, certainly, but maybe save someone from leaving the church, maybe giving them just the right kind of advice or giving them the right kind of encouragement and helping them through whatever struggle they're going through. Or maybe save someone's marriage by being there and being a willing listener at a time when they're crying out for help. Maybe someone has a financial problem that causes them to reach out and open up to you. These moments are, I think, especially powerful because it helps to build bridges between people who have totally different backgrounds, like most of us do. We come from different backgrounds, but we've been bonded, we've been bound together because of God's Holy Spirit. It is what creates trust and closeness between friends and between spouses. It can extend to your stopping and helping a stranger along the road who's broken down or has perhaps run out of gas. Maybe you have been placed in that particular place at that particular time, and you can draw all kinds of pictures and think of all kinds of scenarios. But maybe you're just there, that you have been drawn into that person's life at that time and at that place to be able to give that person the right kind of help or the right kind of assistance that they needed. Well, Esther risked her life by appealing to the king, and he held out the golden scepter, which gave her the license to come in and talk to him when he could just as easily have put her to death for intruding. She took that chance, though. She risked her life in order to save her nation, her race, I should say. So instead, he listened to her. Haman, the man that had precipitated the writing of this edict, was hanged. Mordecai was moved up, promoted, and the Jews were given the license to defend themselves. The king could not change the edict once it was written. There was no way of changing it, but they were able to tell the Jews that they could defend themselves, which they did, and they thus saved their lives. You know, as we walk through our Christian lives, we're going to encounter roadblocks, we're going to encounter obstacles, we're going to encounter hurdles that are going to trigger this belief that until we've overcome this particular thing, we really won't be able to get on with their lives. I think some of you have probably heard the expression, "I've got your six." Well, I was exposed to it, even though I'd been in the Navy and served on an aircraft carrier around young naval pilots. I had never heard that expression used when I was in the Navy. I picked it up from JAG, that TV program where the main star was not only an attorney, but was also a jet pilot. And they were always talking about, "I've got your six, I've got your six." I never did understand what that meant until finally I did it, you know, I looked it up. It was pretty easy to find out what it meant. But all you have to do is visualize yourself in the center of a clock. And straight ahead is 12. If you go to your right, perpendicular to you, 3 o'clock is over here. 9 o'clock is over here. And directly behind you is 6 o'clock. You're 6. Your most vulnerable part of your body, your most vulnerable part as a pilot, because while you have vision up here and perhaps can turn your head, you can't see directly behind you. And that part of you is the most vulnerable. I remember when I was dating a girl in high school, I met her father. And he was telling me of his experiences in the Second World War. He'd been a tail gunner and a bomber. And he was telling me a little bit about the position of the tail gunner. It was very, very difficult. And I don't see how they could go on long missions and be in those kind of positions that they were required to be in. But nonetheless, they did. And I read or heard someplace that the life expectancy of a tail gunner in battle was only 30 seconds. And one of the reasons being that the tail, the six of the plane, the rudder, was very critical. If it got knocked out and then, you know, the fighter strafed it, the plane loses its maneuverability and then becomes or can become a sitting duck. So anyway, that's where that came from. If someone tells you they've got your six, it means they've got your back. They're there to back you up. Turn to Psalms 34, verse 19. Psalm 34, verse 19. This is one of my favorite scriptures. Many are the afflictions of the righteous. That's a guarantee. We're going to have them. You don't know what size or shape they're going to be. You don't know where they're coming from in your life, but I'll guarantee you. It says right here, God tells us, many are the afflictions of the righteous. But the Eternal delivereth him out of them all. God has your six. Jesus has your six. They're backing you up, regardless of what your situation is. They have your six. They want to get you out of the problem that you're in. I remember one of the boys that I went to high school with had a brother, a younger brother, who died in an automobile accident. No, it wasn't an automobile accident. He just had a sudden heart attack and killed him at a very young age. And this friend of mine could not go to the funeral. He just refused to go. As much as he loved his brother, it was his only brother. Emotionally, that was devastating to him. And I asked someone that knew the family why he was so adamant about not going. And they said, and of course I knew this as well, he had two sons. And probably a dozen years before this, one of those sons was killed in an automobile accident. And he was absolutely devastated by that. But he was even more devastated by the fact that the man responsible lived. And so, I don't remember, like I say, it was another classmate told me that he drove down to where this man lived. And he was just fuming. And he drove back and forth in front of his house. And finally stopped. He went up, knocked on the door, and said to the man, "Do you know what you've done to my family?" I think you would all have to be very careful about doing something like that now, because the way people are and the way they react to something like that, you could just as well get shot down right on the front steps of that house. Nonetheless, that was what he did. And I don't think being able to say that helped him any. Maybe it did momentarily. But he had changed after that. Every time I'd see him at a reunion or a class picnic or something, I could tell he still had this bitterness. And that had really affected him. And it wasn't surprising to me that, oh, I guess it's been about 6 or 7 years ago, he and his wife were vacationing in Phoenix. He had a major heart attack and almost died there. And he was touch and go. He was in ER for a number of days. Finally pulled through that. Then they sent him to Everett for rehabilitation. Finally out to Monroe because he lived in Salton. And I used to stop after work at the convalescent center out there and visit him. But this had really affected his life. He never was able to really get on with his life after this. And the thing that's sad about that is he became so stalled because of this one incident that now the remaining years of his life, however they may be, are going to be spent with coping with this additional handicap because he's partially paralyzed. He has to use a wheelchair. He sleeps in the living room in one of these hospital beds and has a slur to his speech. And I just know that that bitterness that happened as a result of his son's death was something that probably maybe not contributed directly, but had a large part, paid a large part of that. Turn to Hebrews 13, verse 5. Hebrews 13, verse 5, where we're told, "Let your conversation or your conduct be without covetousness and be content with such things as you have." He has said, "I will never leave you. I will never forsake you." We have that promise from God. I've got your six. I will protect you. I'm never going to leave you. I'm never going to forsake you. It doesn't make any difference what you do, how bad it is, what it does in your life. I'm never going to cast you away. I've got your six. Ask yourself this question on the eve of Pentecost. Is the Holy Spirit working in my life? Am I using it? Am I listening to it? Am I encouraging it? Am I allowing it to motivate me to change and to mold my life? You know, if you really want to get on with your life, wherever that is in your lifespan at this time, then be sure to pay close attention to the messages tomorrow on the day of Pentecost, because although you may have thought, "Well, I've heard this before. I know what is going to be said." If you listen closely, really listen, you just may hear something that will give you a different slant, that will put a spotlight on something for you at this place in your life, at this time of your life, that will help you to become motivated and to move ahead and give you exactly what you really need to have to move on with your life.